Hi, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual health, hormonal health, and genitourinary health. And actually, Dr. Rubin, I used to introduce myself as a men's health specialist, and now I've changed my introduction because of you. So I have Dr. Rachel Rubin here with me today. Please give the audience a brief introduction.
Oh my gosh, the best words ever, right? So, I'm Rachel Rubin. I am a urologist. I did fellowship training in sexual medicine. I did the one fellowship program that really acknowledged everybody's sexual health. I started my own practice about 3 years ago where we do comprehensive sexual medicine, where we take care of everybody. And I'm just so thrilled to be here and to hear you say that you've evolved your own practice and your own knowledge base. You know, this idea that doctors can learn new things is no better way to present that than the American Urologic Association meeting, where we're all here to learn new things and to watch you expand your practice and your confidence. Is there is no better feeling truly out there.
That's amazing. I love that. So we're gonna get into the weeds here because you're playing a big role at this AUA meeting in Las Vegas. You've been a part of two courses. I don't know too many people that are instructors of more than even one. It's hard enough to get one course in. So can you talk about the courses that you've been a part of at the AUA?
Yeah, we've been a part of a number of courses, and they actually have a rule at the AUA that you can't teach more than two courses. So when you get invited to teach more than two courses, they politely tell you no. I have experienced that no quite a few times actually. And so it was really it's sometimes difficult to know which courses to sort of invest in, but we had two amazing courses at this AUA. The first one was on pelvic pain. And what was so great about this course was it was managing pelvic everybody's pelvis. So it was
The
comprehensive.
pelvi.
The all the if you have a pelvis, you can get pelvic pain. And so it was a brilliant group of really good speakers who were bringing in really different viewpoints of pelvic pain. And really, the whole goal was really actionable ways to navigate pelvic pain. Most doctors don't want to deal with pelvic pain. They say, oh, this is too complex. I don't even want to begin. And it's giving a toolbox and giving the actionable things that you can do in your practice starting on Monday, you know, to really say, okay, how can I approach these patients? So I encourage anybody who has a course pass to listen on demand if you didn't go. Well, the feedback that we got was that there was really, really actionable things to take away. And someone even wrote that, like, I never thought I'd hear such a joyful presentation about pelvic pain before. So we're trying to present it in a way that is interesting and tolerable and fun because it matters how you present things.
Absolutely.
The other course, which we have on Tuesday morning, which I am so thrilled about, it's the second year that we're teaching it, is the course on genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And tomorrow it feels bigger than a birthday. Tomorrow they are releasing the guidelines in genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And this has been a labor of love and an advocacy project of many of ours for many years now. And so this course, it's the guidelines chairs, which was Melissa Kaufman and Una Lee and myself are going to be teaching this course. And it's really just what are the guidelines going to say? How do you navigate and manage genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which you do now in your practice, which is so excellent. Really thrilled to bring this all to the AUA.
So many of us rely on these guidelines for clinical practice, but have no idea what the process is for creating guidelines. Walk us through that process.
Neither did I. And actually, what is so cool about the process is that it is truly this collaborative group effort. And watching it happen and gather consensus, and it was truly multidisciplinary. So while I can't give too much away, we had representation from not just the AUA, but SUFU, OGS, the Urogynecology Society. We had endorsement and representation from the Menopause Society, from the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, or ISWISH. And so there were many different, we even had patient advocates in the guidelines committee, which was so beautiful to get that patient voice. And watching these subgroups get together to come up with this document and watching the discussions, the evidence, watching the evidence report come out and watching the evolution of them. I mean, this is a multi-year process. And then seeing the final document, I just cried like a baby, to be honest. Very embarrassing, but this, it's a truly, it will truly save lives. And this isn't just about urology, which is so, this problem is so large. And we've published on this idea that we could save Medicare between $6 and $22 billion a year if women in Medicare use vaginal estrogen. There's a paper in this meeting that looks at the reduction in sepsis, mortality, hospitalizations in patients. They looked at their hospital database and the patients who took vaginal estrogen, there was so much less morbidity and mortality. And so this document gives permission to clinicians of every kind, of every specialty, to say, hey, guys, this is not just a little vaginal dryness that's uncomfortable. This is sepsis, death, decrease in sexual health, urinary overactivity, urinary tract infections. This is urology. Mm-hmm. And by giving women vaginal hormones, not just estrogen, we will save lives. And the permission, the safety to say this isn't, doesn't cause cancer. Mm-hmm. This, if you even have cancer, this is something that shared decision-making can be a part of. And here's the data. It's elegant. It's beautiful. It is just truly a labor of love.
Yeah. And not to say that it's difficult to teach old dogs new tricks, because it is possible if someone is willing, but it also gives the ability to teach trainees who are now going to have to look at the guidelines. They're going to be tested on the guidelines.
Yeah.
So you get them when they're younger.
Yes. That's awesome.
And that's what's really fun is yeah. if it's in guidelines, it gets tested. It gets tested.
And I think when we are board certified in urology, we are board certified to take care of men and women. And we do not often give our trainees the tools to do a great job of taking care of women completely. And you should not have to be a fellowship trained clinician in women's urology in order to take care of women. And I think this sets a very clear message, which I and the AUA has really done a beautiful thing by putting out these guidelines.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you're educating people at the AUA, but you're really leading the charge on educating people, really, I mean, providers and pay, I mean, you're educating everyone, right? But you've done a lot of different things in terms of education. How do you go about deciding how you're going to educate a certain group?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have passion sort of coming out my ears, right? Because I think it comes from a place where the things I do feel very simple, and yet nobody's doing them, right? Like I'm actually not doing any brain surgery or anything too complex that requires like really fancy technology, and I feel like it should be better. And I feel like, you know, even rich celebrities are getting terrible care when it comes to menopause health, hormonal health, and genitourinary health. And so I feel like it is my responsibility to not only try to get more research and knowledge of what we don't know, but I feel a deep responsibility of giving people the tools that we already do know, because people aren't using what we already have and they're not using it well. And people are, it's really causing problems. So we have a really big challenge because we have to teach clinicians. We also have to teach patients, and we also have to and it has to be both at the same time, because you can't just rally the patient
right.
if you don't train the clinicians.
And they're super frustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing happening, because there are now many loud voices on social media, and not just mine. And so it's sort of that navigating that piece of it. But then you have to arm the clinicians as well. I was asked to speak this year at the American College of Physicians, which is a large internal medicine conference. They get none of this, right? And this should be primary care. This should be gynecology. This should be urology. And it ends up, when it's everybody's problem, it's nobody's problem.
Right.
And so
like a bystander.
Yeah. And so nobody does it. And so I'm trying. I don't know why my voice carries. I don't know anyone listening. I'm an introvert. I'll tell you. I really am an introvert. And I don't have a face, you know, like I got a face for radio. So, but this idea of like, I don't know why my voice carries.
Yeah.
I don't know why people listen. But as long as they're listening, I'm going to talk, because we're seeing change, right? To watch these guidelines actually happen, that I, you know, that we help to advocate for them. How can I stop? How can I not want this for everybody?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two things that you're doing that really stand out in terms of why your voice is so loud and is changes people's practices. And one is what you already said, you simplify it. Because in so many aspects of our scientific meetings, we go up on stage and we complicate it because we want to show the audience how freaking smart we are, you know? But then when you do that, you eliminate a lot of people in the audience that are actually going to have the bandwidth to do that. And you do the opposite. You simplify it. So people say, I think I can implement this tomorrow, exactly what you said with that course. The other question that you ask a lot is, what are you afraid of? I love that question. And at the end of the day, there's a lot there. It's difficult to hurt people with these medications, right? Now, even outside of the courses that you're doing and what you've discussed so far, do you want to highlight the online course that you did?
Yeah.
Which changed my practice.
Right. Yeah. So I can't educate fast enough.
Yeah.
And so one of my dreams, one of the favorite things that I do, you know, as a urologist, giving men testosterone therapy is truly, as you know, mm-hmm. is truly life-changing for these patients who need it, who aren't getting validated by other clinicians, and they do so well, mm-hmm. right? Men with low testosterone, their gas tank is like a quarter tank full. It's getting low. And by just topping them off a little bit, you change their lives. And we know that from research. You change their sexual health. You change their muscle mass. Like, you make them feel like them.
Yeah.
So fun. I do the exact same thing for women with hormone therapy in perimenopause and menopause. And it is, not only is it the same story, but women, their gas tanks aren't a little empty. They're empty. Like, this is a castration level event, and it affects our patients' sexual health. It affects their genitourinary health. And then who knew that I was going to be treating so much bone density and joint pain and skin and hair issues? I didn't realize as a urologist, but when you give back hormones safely through evidence-based medicine, you change couples and relationships and lives, right? I help so many men's sex lives by helping their female partner. And really, that couple's approach to sexual medicine is really important. So what Dr. Perlman is referring to is, I have now gotten interested in, because I'm good at simplifying things and really breaking it down and saying, here's how to write the prescription, right? Then I am now working on physician, you know, ways that we can train more clinicians to know how to do this and to have them, give them the confidence that they know how to practice safe, evidence-based sort of women's hormonal health kind of a thing. So yeah, so you were in the pilot.
Yeah.
You're the OG group. We're working on the second round, which hopefully in the next couple of months, we'll have CME credit and things like that, you know, too. And it is just to gather and get people excited and to feel that they have mentorship. I think, you know, when you and I learned how to do penile prostheses, I remember actually your fellowship director has a video on YouTube of like how he does, you know, his penis. I remember watching that video and be like, oh, I like that move. And I've incorporated, I didn't do his fellowship, and yet I've incorporated his moves in my implants. Okay. And just like, I look at how different people do things. You go to these meetings to find out different tips. Ooh, I like that move. I like that move. Well, when it comes to menopause hormone therapy, there's no place to go to learn people's moves. And it is a little bit of a nuanced tinker. Oh, I like how that person counsels on estrogen. Oh, what pharmacy do we get the ring from versus the patch versus the gel? You know, if you're never taught the moves, you don't have a toolbox to know how to tinker, which means you don't do it at all.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to just be an additional voice in this space to say, hey, let me teach you my moves.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's the only moves, right? There's other moves. Dance got it. Right? Like, there's other moves. And it really comes down to that, having that mentorship of someone is there to like guide you, right? And then that point of, what are you afraid of? And there is the risks of, you know, one thing I love teaching people is, there's the risks of giving a woman hormone therapy, but then we don't talk about the risks of not giving someone hormone therapy, right? If you have a man who is a Klinefelter's patient, if you don't give him back testosterone, what happens? Osteoporosis, depression, erectile dysfunction, heart disease, metabolic, you know, like all these things.
Yeah.
We don't talk about that when it comes to women.
That's a very great way of putting it. The risk of not doing something.
Yeah,
I love that. So a lot of people, as they're preparing for the AUA, they're preparing like a year in advance. You have a huge research team, right? Oftentimes we think you have to be in an academic practice in order to do research. You have a super robust team mentoring students from all over the country, maybe even world. I don't know if you have any international students. So what questions are you currently trying to answer?
Oh, we have a lot of research projects going on. And it's this idea, you know, I think COVID taught this to us, that you do not need to be in one institution in the same space as someone to be productive. And so we take medical students. We meet once a month on Zoom. Please, we call ourselves the Sexual Medicine Research Team. Come to our website, sign up, come to our meetings. And we have mentors, we have mentees. And my whole point is to teach students you do not need to be an expert in research to be productive in research. And it is truly this collaborative process. And I am sometimes stunned at how many papers we publish when I'm like, wait, I still don't really know how to do this, this, and that, because we have a team. You know, it's amazing. Yeah. Because of Twitter, actually, we have a woman who comes to our meetings every month who is a science librarian from Yale. And she has helped us publish all these systematic reviews, and she'll teach and she'll talk. And she comes there out of the goodness of her heart because she believes in the mission.
Yeah.
So we have published extensively on all these various topics. We've published a recent publication I'm super proud of is a systematic review on the labia minora and like what the homologs and the nerve, just how little we know about the labia minora. We've been publishing quite a bit on curriculum and just the lack of education in medical school and in residency about sexual health for women and men. We've published a lot on post-orgasmic illness syndrome for men. We have all these cool projects going on. And what's so beautiful is I'm teaching the students that like you have to champion a topic. And I will do, we actually, another one I'm super proud of that we're about to get a huge publication in the big OBGYN Green Journal about genitourinary syndrome of lactation. So this idea of GSM is not just, and the guidelines will hopefully reflect this, is not just about menopause. When you are breastfeeding or lactating or pumping, like you will have genital and urinary changes. So we're doing a ton of projects on what we're calling GSL, or genitourinary syndrome of lactation. And so what is so cool is I am so happy to sponsor and support the students in this space. They come on my Medscape video blog. I put them out on social media. I get them because I'm trying to teach them. Okay. It is not enough. First of all, thank you. And I need you to write the papers. But it's actually not enough to write the papers. I need you to tell everybody about, I need you to get loud about it. Mm-hmm. So for example, we have a resident. I had a resident. She's now, I just saw her here. She's now an attending. In her chief year, she wrote a paper that we collaborated on that said, if we give women in Medicare vaginal estrogen, you could save Medicare between $6 and $22 billion a year. It was published in the Urology Practice Journal. I don't know about you, but not a lot of people up beyond this space read the Urology Practice Journal, right? The last couple of weeks, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, was standing in a whole meeting with a piece of paper that contained that paper and what we were trying to do with that paper. Why was Gretchen Whitmer talking about our dinky paper in the Urology Practice Journal? Because of advocacy, because of social media, because of getting loud about the research, and to show the students that there is a direct line between us caring about a topic and creating guidelines, or us talking about a topic and changing legislation, or talking about that. And that is what should motivate them to want to champion a project and get loud about something. So it's so joyful. Like in a time where it's sometimes hard to find joy, it is so joyful working with these students. I know I went very long-winded on that answer there, but it's just really beautiful.
Well, I think that last piece is something that we're not really taught, right? We're taught that like once you get the paper published, that's kind of like it, like rinse and repeat. But the most important piece is how do you use that knowledge and actually change not only clinical practice, but like the world.
Yeah.
Because it's not even enough to just present an abstract at a meeting.
Yeah.
That's not enough.
It's not enough. And yeah. and it's so, the work that we are doing is so important for the world. And so I always tell the students, I said, nothing frustrates me more. I get Google alerts of different research topics, and I watch what research is coming in, and nothing frustrates me more in women's sexual health than the papers that come in and say women with MS have sexual dysfunction, and women with diabetes have sexual dysfunction, and women with rheumatoid arthritis have sexual dysfunction. No. Of course, everybody has sexual dysfunction. What are we going to do about it, right? Like I'm frustrated that is as much as the research goes into.
Right, right, right.
And so whenever my students are coming up with ideas of projects, I was like, we got to go the next step.
Right.
So when we named genitourinary syndrome of lactation, we gave it a name and we did a brief review, a review, and it got published. And I sat the student down, who's a brilliant student. She's only a second year med student. Mm-hmm. And she's so smart. And I sat her down and I said to her, this is not enough. You must make every OBGYN in the country know this term, use this term, and we must study every outcome. We must publish on all of the treatments that we are going to make this not a problem anymore.
Wow.
And you are going, your whole career could be on this topic, and you will have research for an entire career. And you just saw the fire in her belly, and you saw how she understood. And she has, this is her project. This is what she cares about. And I'm here to just like cheerlead along the way. And that's the problem, is we have so many topics just as important as this. And so how do we inspire people to want to champion these topics and get excited about it? And so that's what I'm trying to do. And gosh, we have so much, you know, it's so much.
You're just getting started.
Maybe. Like it is. It's kind of crazy.
I love it. Dr. Rubin, it is always such a pleasure chatting with you. And I've been following your career, obviously, for many years. Your career has helped inspire my career. And your career is inspiring a lot of colleagues that we know in terms of changes that they might be making. And you truly have a practice that is shared decision-making, multidisciplinary, and we can all learn so much from what you're doing. And you're changing the world, which #change the world. Love it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you all for tuning in.